Welcome back to Muppets in Space, a Farscape Rewatch podcast on The Incomparable. Tonight, we are covering Season 1, Episode 13, The Flax, and Episode 14, Jeremiah Crichton. I'm your host, Eric Scott, and joining me, as always, my fellow co-host, someone who does actually live out in the middle of nowhere, Jason Johnson.
Yeah, don't mind me. I'm just making myself at home out here by the water. It's nice. I've got a little campsite set up, some fire. Yeah, good to go.
The hurricane passed by you, no problem. So.
Yeah. We didn't even catch any rain or wind off that. It was nice.
And this will be your final reminder for Season 1 that we are following the Wikipedia episode order for Season 1, not the Amazon Prime order, since Amazon flipped things around here and there. And I did actually compare the list, and this is the last time in Season 1 that the orders are different. So after this, no more warning, you know, episode 15 and 16 and on, everything's in the same order. So no more confusion and jumping around, wondering what we're talking about when you watch the wrong episode that we watched and that kind of stuff. All right. So without further ado, let's get into episode 13, The Flax. Aaron is teaching John how to fly a transport pod so he can get more familiar with Leviathan technology and technology, I guess, in that part of the universe. But it's kind of taken him a while to get the hang of it. Meanwhile, on Moya, Rigel is bored. And Dargo is angry that parts of Moya are starting to smell because of her pregnancy, or as we call it, continuity. Aaron says she's teaching Crichton in the hope that someday he'll end up being some use to her in battle. The pod that they're in gets pulled towards something and hits some kind of net. They can't go forward or backward, and the pod gets damaged. Sensors say there's nothing out there, but something is definitely blocking their view. Back on Moya, Zan, Rigel, and Dargo are bickering, so Pilot, quote-unquote, accidentally, hits the wrong button to make a noise and get their attention. He says a ship is approaching with weapon pieces on board, but nothing usable. On board that ship was a Senatan garbologist named Stans, who says they need him, but if Dargo kills him, Zan will be angry that he killed the man they needed. He knows that they are headed for the Flax, a magna drift mesh 75 million Zacrons long. And I looked up Zacron, and it doesn't really say what that is, so we have no idea how big that is. But 75 million of them must be pretty big. It's invisible to sensors, though, and was put there by Zenitan pirates. Zan says she'll warn Crichton and Aaron. Stans notices Rigel's Tadic board and tells Rigel he also plays that game. Rigel says maybe Stans could give him some pointers. Aaron tells Crichton that they're not moving at all, no drift or anything. There's no comms signal, even though it's working, but the power is being drained. Zan says they're not responding and wonders what Stans will want in return for his help. Dargo says he wants anything he can get. Dargo accesses the Peacekeeper criminal records on board Moya and finds out that Stans has quite a record, so he wants him off the ship immediately. Rigel says he got him right where he wants him in the game when Dargo interrupts, grabbing Stans and asking why he has a criminal record. Stans says he used to be a pirate, but he's not anymore. Zan tells him two of their crew are out there somewhere and they can't find them. Meanwhile, Aaron manages to send a message buoy out while Crichton restores some power. Dargo meanwhile notices Stans is wearing Luxon boots and locks him up, saying that a Luxon would never leave his boots unless he was dead. Stans says he was already dead, killed by the pirates. Dargo asks him to take him to that Luxon ship, since he needs some map fibers. If he gets them, Stans can have everything else on board the Luxon ship. Back on the pod, Aaron and Crichton are trying to escape the Flax, but they end up getting swung back and doing even more damage to the pod. Crichton puts out some fires that developed while Aaron tries to get her foot loose from being stuck under some debris. Zan, meanwhile, has received the message buoy when Dargo says he and Stans are leaving on Stans' vessel. Dargo says they'll spend no longer than an Arn on the Luxon ship and then go get Aaron and Crichton. However, they have to avoid the pirate leader Kratzik's scanner. They do, but Kratzik's ship is headed towards Moya. On board, Zan greets them, and Kratzik says they're lucky that the Leviathan is pregnant or he would commandeer it. When asked, Zan tells them she doesn't know Stans and introduces them to Rigel. Back on the pod, Crichton says the environmental controls and environmental systems are damaged and they can't use the repair torch because of the pure oxygen buildup. It would set the pod on fire. Aaron says they can depressurize the bay and get in their spacesuits and have enough air. But then part of the superstructure or something falls and Crichton pushes her out of the way and falls on top of her in the process. She jokingly says, "Are you comfortable? Can I get you a pillow?" Meanwhile, Stans' ship has stopped, and when they manage to get it going again, they also get caught in the Flax. Back on Moya, Rigel is playing Kratzik, and when he starts losing, he says he knows what he's doing. Back on the pod, only one of the two helmets from their environmental suits is undamaged, which means only one of them will have air. Aaron shows John chemicals called a kill shot and a nerve shot, which will kill her but allow her to be revived later after Crichton repairs the environmentals. Unfortunately, Crichton says that it was his helmet that was damaged and he won't fit inside Aaron's helmet. So he tells her what to do to fix the environmentals because they don't have much time to wait for the others to come rescue them. Back on Moya, Rigel uses one of Stanza's moves during the game, and Kratchik questions him and asks where he learned that because he knows somebody else who uses that same move. Back on the pod, Crichton tells Aaron he doesn't trust the kill shot, so he teaches her CPR, just in case. Back on the Stanza ship, Stanza manages to dissolve a small particle of the flax, and they break through and continue on towards the Luxon ship. Back on the pod, Aaron gives Crichton the kill shot, which starts to take effect. On Moya, Rigel loses again to Kratchik, but says he wants one more game. He says he'll wager Moya, but Kratchik doesn't want it, Moya, so for some reason he agrees to wager the location of Stanza instead, much to Zan's dismay and shock, and I guess anger. Back on the pod, Aaron runs out of time during her work, and instead of finishing, decides to resuscitate Crichton with a nerf shot, but on her way towards him, she gets knocked out. Meanwhile, Rigel thinks he's won the game, but in fact, Kratchik wins and wants information on Stanza's whereabouts. Rigel says they can find him by following their comm frequency, which is in Moya's data store. Aaron wakes up to find out that the vial containing the nerf shot was smashed, so she starts CPR on John. Back on Stanza's ship, they find the Luxon ship, an assault piercer, which Dargo says he dreamt of serving on as a boy. Crichton, meanwhile, starts breathing again, yay, and says Aaron lied that killshot hurt like hell. Unfortunately, they've got half an arn of air left. Kratchik and the other pirate leave Moya, and Zan is angry with Rigel again, but he says that he told Pilot the moment Kratchik arrived to change the frequency of the comms, so they're headed to someplace far away. He lost on purpose, knowing that Kratchik wouldn't leave with nothing. Back on Sansa's ship, Stan says that Dargo will soon have his own piercer, and tells him to think of all the maps he'll get, and he'll be able to find his son. Dargo says that when he does, though, he wants to be able to look him in the eye, because he's having second thoughts about going to the ship versus rescuing Crichton and Aaron. Back on the pod, Crichton tells Aaron that she should have saved herself, but she says she chose not to be alone. She says she does not want to die alone. Then they turn and kiss each other, but they don't stop there, ripping off parts of each other's spacesuits and rolling on the floor, when suddenly Dargo walks in with a priceless look on his face. Awkwardly, Crichton asks what took him so long, so Dargo says he needed someone to help him. He's tied up Stans because he's merely annoying. Stans asks if Dargo will go with him, to which Dargo merely laughs. Stans says he's lonely, everybody needs a mate. After odd looks, he says he's the female of his species. In fact, she's considered quite the Zenitan beauty. Dargo is speechless and still leaves him tied to his flight control chair on the ship. Back on Moya, Zan asks Dargo what happened, and he says his indecision nearly cost Crichton and Aaron their lives. He says he barely saved them, and he may have given up his only chance to ever see his son. Aaron and Crichton try to make excuses for what happened back on the pod, and he says it'll never happen again, to which she also replies, never again. Crichton asks, though, just to be certain, if she's the female of the species, and kind of off-camera but implied, she kind of grabs his crotch, which he takes as a yes, and they both smile. The end. Some trivia about this episode. Rockne O'Bannon, one of the creators, remembered that this episode was like a crucible. We put two people in one spot and saw how they functioned and survived. It was a really good Crichton and Aaron episode, and we got to see the sacrifices that one would make for the other. It was a window on the relationship that was to come. And speaking of that, he also admitted that he thought Crichton and Aaron would get together from the start, but it was never set in stone. He told the writing staff that any of these relationships can go anywhere, and a lot of that is going to be dependent upon the actors' chemistries with each other. Although he did go on to point out that Aaron and John are soulmates, meant for each other, and the end point of the relationship was that the two of them were meant for each other, but that wasn't planned to happen by episode 8. It just took until episode 13. And Claudia Black joked that this was her favorite episode of the season because she got to kiss Ben Browder. All right, so Jason, what did you think of The Flax?
You know, I think it was definitely an episode that had some highs and lows. We're definitely well into the characters in the season. I think that, and we'll hit some highlights, but I think that the Aaron and John scenes were really good. I think some of the rest of it was a lot of filler and just kind of moving the characters in the background. But I think that it definitely moved the plot forward, and we got a lot of character development between Aaron and John.
Yeah, I'll kind of agree with that. The Aaron and John parts were the best. The other bits with Stans and the pirates either alternately annoyed me or just made me confused. And I guess we'll get into that as we go.
Yeah, I'll say that if this was done today and they weren't trying to focus as much on getting every actor and every character on the screen as much as I think they were at the time this was filmed, you might see this as almost more of a isolated episode where you might see the other characters at the very beginning, you know, even up to the implication of Dargo leaving to go check for the map. And then you wouldn't see anything more of them until the very end when John and Aaron are rescued and the rest of the episode would focus solely on them. I think it lost a lot with the bouncing back and forth and trying to make sure everybody had screen time.
Yeah, because with, you know, reading the recap, it's basically like John and Aaron do this. Back on the ship, they do that. Back on the pod, back on the Stasis pod, they do this. Back on the ship, it's like, it bounced around like every like minute. They're jumping around to the different, I don't know, A, B, and C, D, whatever, how many plots, that they're trying to cram into this thing. But when, yeah, nowadays it'd be like 75, 80% Aaron and Crichton on the pod, and more, like, what do you call it, depth, seriousness. And lighthearted, they're trying to make fun of it while they're being serious about what's happening, but that would be what it would be mostly about. And then, oh yeah, the rest of them are trying to find them.
And I think it would have helped a little more with the Dargo entry scene, right? If we didn't have any idea that he had even considered giving up his chase for them. I think it could have worked that a little bit, but overall, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I guess the parts that we liked, like it's nice to see that John's continuing to learn about the new technology he's surrounded with, on this part of the universe. He's trying to figure out how to fly something besides Farscape 1, and it's not easy. I mean, you would think because space civilizations should be like really more advanced than ours that maybe their ships would be easier to control, right? But not the case for humans, or maybe like what's easy for Sabbatians and Luxans and whatever isn't necessarily the same aesthetic or thought processes of how you would control a ship as compared to a human, how they would fly it.
Yeah, and I like the fact that they use the fact that he's putting a lot more of Moya's technology into his pod slash ship, whatever you want to call it, the Farscape One, and that's part of his impetus for familiarizing himself with the technology. Not to mention he's completely dependent on it in their universe, right? I mean, he's not exactly going to find any Earth tech laying around, so it kind of makes sense and gives him a logical reason to do what he does.
Yeah, I mean, he's kind of stuck with the fact that yeah, you're not going to find off the shelf micro cassette recording device whatever in this side of the universe. So you have to make do with what you have, right? And integrate it with you're not changing, you can't rebuild the outside of the ship, but you can at least replace the parts inside and make things still work. And we actually have some pilot scenes finally, other than just him regurgitating what Moya is saying or what what they're seeing. So it was kind of funny how, I guess, to get the crew's attention when they're arguing, as always, that he has the comm system emit like a loud shrieking noise, and he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry, I hit the wrong button." So, pilot, a sense of humor, who knew?
Yeah, good humor from Pilot. We definitely need more Pilot in the episodes. He's brought out occasionally, but we don't get to see him near as much. I mean, I kind of figured when we started that we'd have him equal to at least Rigel, especially as much as you figure that animatronic slash puppet cost them. But it seems like he just barely gets any screen time. So more Pilot.
Yep, I agree. Yeah, he can't move from his little chamber, so it's good to at least have him interacting holographically or whatever with the crew, and at least showing more of a personality than just the subservient, okay, cut my arm off, I'm fine with it in previous episodes, and that's all we get, right? So,
Right.
and also on moving along with the character development stuff, finally, nobody just wants to leave John and Aaron behind. They weren't like, okay, we're out of here. They're gone. Oh well, it's been 5 seconds. Let's leave, guys. So at least we're finally getting away from that, whatever you call it, plot device, drama element, whatever.
Yeah, I think, and I might mention this some when we talk about the next episode also, but if I were laying this out, I'd have flipped these two episodes in order, because obviously, the next episode, without spoiling too much, is going to be addressing a marooned crew member. And it seems like in this episode, we've already moved past the will they leave them, will they not thing. So, in my mind, these could have been flipped and had a little more consistency. But I agree. It's time to be a team and not worry about leaving, not leaving. So, it's good to see that they just kind of don't even mention that this time and roll straight into rescue mode.
Yeah, I mean, there's more room or more elements they could have for conflict within the crew or little tension building moments than just, you left me, or, oh, they're gone, who cares? So, yeah, I'm glad that they're kind of moving past that.
Until next time.
Yeah, well, until we'll talk about next episode briefly for one little scene, but yeah. And I guess moving into some of the parts that confused me or annoyed me about this episode, I know I'm gonna get into all of it because whatever, but something about sci-fi shows and their games that nobody knows about, but does everybody know about this Tattic game? Like, this is the first time we've seen it, and two different sets of pirates have come on board going, "You have Tattic? That's great, let's play." I'm like, "You want to play now?" I'm like, what? Like, is this like the hottest game in the universe, and you just have to play it? It's like addictive. Like, I don't understand why both these, well, former pirate and current pirate, just wanted to like drop everything and start playing for with Rigel on this game. I didn't get it.
It does seem kind of contrived how at the beginning episode you've got everybody complaining. Well, you got Rigel complaining about being bored, as everybody kind of has their issues at the beginning of the episode. And his is that he's sitting there banging the stick, that we have no concept of how this game's played. And it seems like everybody who comes on board the ship after that is immediately drawn to the game, right? And it's like you say, it's almost like a, okay, now we're going to focus on this game because we spent some money on this set piece and we want to make sure everybody centers around it for this episode. So yeah, I don't know if it'll be a recurring thing that everybody's addicted to or has to play this game that they're familiar with, but it's definitely the Sabacc of this episode anyway.
Yeah, and I guess even though I didn't quite like the game, or at least the addiction or the obsession with the game idea, I did kind of like how Rigel used it to play the pirate leader into giving him into losing on purpose and feeding him the wrong coordinates or the wrong comm frequency so that they would leave and go like totally the wrong direction. I mean, it did seem kind of too perfect. Like that just kind of fit exactly like how you want it to happen, which usually doesn't happen except for on TV shows, but I'll give him credit for that at least.
And you get a chance for Rigel to be competent. I mean, yeah, most of the time in all their adventures and things you see them do, Rigel comes off as the inconsequential gag. And here we see that he's actually really good at playing other people. And so I did like that aspect of it as well.
Yeah, and these two episodes, which we'll get into next episode too, Rigel has a lot more to do also. So they're kind of broadening Rigel's horizons or his character development. You know, he's growing, he's learning. He's not just the glutton, scheming con artist, although this was kind of scheming con artist thing too, but it actually worked this time. So it was good.
You gotta get them up at Earnest Keep, man.
Yep. And I guess the only other annoying thing for me anyway was Stanza's ship. To me, made no sense. It's an advanced space-capable ship, but yet it works like an old locomotive from the 1800s. You know, you have to put like these little combustible dolls or food or whatever it was into like a furnace, and then use bellows to like pump air, and then you're like whacking parts of it, which to make it work. Which okay, I mean, it's funny when you the high-tech thing they whack. I mean, you know, Han Solo goes into the cockpit of the Millennium Falcon, it lights up, then lights go off, he bangs the side of it, and it comes back on again. Okay, that's funny, I get it. At least you aren't using air bellows on the Falcon to make it fly. That part just really, every time they kept going back to his ship, it just kept taking me out of the episode, because I kept being like, why? What's the point?
So I'll admit, I laughed. I thought that was humorous the first time I saw it. You can't think about it too much because it does break down under any form of scrutiny at all. I just kind of looked at it as a steampunk type approach and moved on, even though steampunk spaceship doesn't hold up too well, like you say, when you're working off of some kind of bellows and furnace. But again, I laughed when I saw it and then just, don't look back. Just keep moving.
Yeah, I mean it's a single person ship, so obviously, yeah, you're everything. You're the pilot, the engineer, the custodial staff, whatever. You're everybody. So I get that it's gonna be run down and beat up and have problems, but I think they kind of like to me they kind of went that one step too far. But yeah, I mean, other than taking me out of the episode, okay, it's cute. I don't know. I guess the other couple of the big points, I guess, was obviously the now that Aaron and Crichton have effectively expressed their love for one another. Or their feelings towards each other. There are kind of hints of it in other episodes here and there. Not necessarily each one didn't know. Kind of like one person knew at that point, and then the other person kind of knew later. But now it's out in the open. Each of them know exactly how each other feels. And as the creator said, they didn't plan this, but once it did happen, they're pretty much, yep, they're perfect for each other. Great, let's go for it.
Yeah, and as we kind of discussed at the beginning, the Crichton Aaron pieces were definitely the best part of this episode, and I'd have been fine if that was really 90% of it. So definitely these were the scenes that caught my attention and thought I really enjoyed the most. So it's going to be fun to see how that plays forward as we go further to the next couple of seasons.
Yeah, because as I said before, I kind of came in after this, and so they were kind of a thing-ish, I think, when I came on. So it's kind of nice to see like how it started and like what I guess finally brought it to the surface for both of them, you know. And then obviously they're trying to play it off like, oh, it's not gonna happen again. No, that was just we're dying. We just, had a final crazed act of whatever you want to call it, lust, love, or dying. Let's do something, you know. But yeah, it's kind of cool to see how it started.
Yeah, and in typical TV show fashion, we'll have to do that a couple more times before it breaks down, right? So.
Yeah, they're not have to build back up to it again, where it's like, you know, remember when we said we forget about it? Well, do you really want to forget about it? You know, whatever. You know, do you really want to forget about it? Well, not really, if you don't want to. You know, who knows? I don't know. We'll see how it, you know, fleshes out as it goes on here. I guess the only other kind of character developy thing on here was, I mean, we talked about before how everybody wants to go home. They have no idea where they are. And, you know, obviously this is a prime chance for Dargo to get on board a Luxan ship that's out there. So they must know where they are, hopefully. And they'll have maps. But he does finally, I guess, let go of that, at least for now anyway, by realizing he's putting his friends ahead of getting home, right? So he basically leaves any chance of seeing his son again. He thinks, who knows? You know, obviously, you know, writers can write whatever they want, but at least he's kind of evolving past his selfishness, I guess you would say.
Yeah, and I'd say this is probably the part that I have to just make sure I don't look at too closely because it does annoy me, is the concept of only these random people who they always get prevented from accessing are the people who have maps. There's one person who has a map. Oh, we can't get it. This person, there's one on this cruiser. Oh, we can't get it. And it's like, I realize that's the concept, is they can't get home, but it seems like it's convenient that every one of the only people who have maps are the ones that they keep getting prevented from. If this many people have maps, then there should be one that's easy to get to. But again, don't look too close, just move on, and we'll keep going.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those, like, it's not like a recurring gag, but it's like a recurring theme of we're trying to get home. Oh, it's right here. I almost had it. Oh, too bad. But yeah, so I
So
mean,
you know what?
at some point with four seasons, they're gonna have to get out of the uncharted territories, or at least know where to go and decide either to go or not to go. But yeah, it's like, okay, we got it. They're lost. Okay, can we please stop?
I'm having flashbacks to the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, you know, when each episode was, oh, we're almost to get, this is our gateway home. Oh, this thing's going to keep us from going through. Well, next episode. And we just keep going. And I feel like that's almost the theme is, you know, we just need the gateway, but we need the plot to let us go through the gateway.
Yeah, it only works for so long, and then you start losing the audience. So hopefully they will stop this at some point. I mean, but whatever. You know, I don't beat a dead horse here. But yeah.
Speaking of dead horses, now there's no dead horses in the next episode, but you want to hit the next one?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really think of anything else to talk about this one. This is probably, I guess, apart from the DNA Mad Scientist episode, probably one of the more, I don't want to say annoying, but less popular, less fun, interesting episode of the season. So, like, yeah, the less we talk about this one, I guess we kind of hit all the good points.
Yeah, again, except for the Crichton Aaron stuff, I'll agree. All right, so episode 14, Jeremiah Crichton. So we open with Dargo and Crichton attempting to unblock a vent on Moya that's been clogged up when Crichton started his pod's engines. They start to bicker, and Crichton continues to be fed up, and he's now used the last of his module's fuel, which now leaves him dependent completely on Moya technology. He leaves Dargo in the middle of the work, and when Zan tries to talk to him, he snaps at her as well. Telling her to leave him alone. He tells Aaron he's going for a drive and that he's sick of everyone on Moya, including her. He loads up into Farscape 1 and takes off, but Moya senses that her baby's at risk and she tries to compensate, which means immediate starburst. Pilot says there's no time to get Crichton back on board and they starburst away, leaving John stranded. We jump forward 3 months and find Crichton laying on top of Farscape 1 down on a planet. He catches a crab-like creature called a Shaklum. And a woman, we find out later, named Lashala, comes out to speak with him, and he asks if she wants some of the food. She says that offering food to a female on Aquaria signals his affection for her. She gives him a map that she made for him of the stars to try to get him home. A man called Rokon comes out and says that her father demands she return to the village. Once alone with John, Rokon tells him that he'll probably need Aquaria, and Crichton says it's the first place that's made him feel like he can live with that. Meanwhile, Moya's still searching, and it's been a quarter of a cycle, and everyone's getting tired, but Dargo feels guilty about them driving Crichton away, and Aaron agrees that they should keep looking. This is despite Zan wanting to give up and move on. Back on the planet, Crichton goes to see the Grandir, Kato Ray, who wants to talk privately with him. He wants to discuss his daughter's heart. Crichton says that he chose to build his home away from the village so that he wouldn't interfere with their ways. We find out that Rokon is jealous that Crichton sits beside the Grandir, and Rokon's mother, the High Priestess Nira, says that John seems to have worked his way into Linshala's heart. She wants her son to marry so he can become the Grandir. So you have a little bit of ambition going on there. Rigel and Dargo land on the planet, but the pod lost all the energy when it went to land. They spot Crichton's pod on their last pass, and Rigel's sled loses power, and he falls to the ground. Meanwhile, Zan wants to either her or Aaron to go down to the planet and find Rigel and Dargo, but Aaron says they can't go without more data. Aaron says that Zan was more agreeable back when she was a priest, but Zan tells her not to go there. There are some lines we should never cross. Back on the planet, Crichton's on his way home when Rokon and some guards ambush him, but just in time, Dargo appears and rescues him. Crichton tells him to get away from him and for Dargo to go back wherever he came from. Rokon returns to the village, but is injured, and L'Challa tends his wounds. Kato Rey says they need to find out more about this other beast, but Neera says Crichton will just bring more evil to Aquira. Rigel is shocked by Crichton's reaction and says that he's the one who sabotaged Moya. Crichton says that they all abandoned him, but Dargo says that he forced Moya to compensate and she starburst on her own. He asks Crichton if he really thinks that they abandoned him when they spent the last quarter of a cycle trying to find him. Crichton is surprised to find that they searched for him and says Rigel and Dargo are stuck there with no power, just like he is. Back on Moya, Pilot has produced a topographic bioprint to try to locate the others on the planet. While Crichton tells Dargo that this is the first place that he's found peace, and L'Challa comes and asks why Crichton brought Dargo here. She says that Crichton must go to her father and convince him that Dargo is not a threat. On their way to the village, Rokon and the guards ambush them again. This time they capture them and take Crichton's possessions, including Rigel, who was hiding. Crichton and Dargo are charged with assaulting the Grandir's personal guards, and the crime carries a sentence of death. But since he believes that Crichton is not entirely to blame, he will only banish them. Neera reminds them that this law is explicit, when all of a sudden Rigel comes out of the bag, startling everyone. The Aquarians start bowing and worshiping him, since he's similar in appearance to the statue of their god. Dargo tells Rigel that they're playing a celebration for him, where he will fulfill his part in the prophecy. Only Dargo and Rigel don't know what that is. Rigel says to Neera that he needs the sacred text to fulfill his part of the prophecy, but she says that only the priestins can read it. Once they get the text, Dargo asks Rigel if he can read it, and he says yes, because it is written in ancient Hynerian. Meanwhile, Crichton finds L'Challa, who is upset because he didn't tell her about Rigel being their Masada. She says that he protected them through the priestins and will take them off the planet whether they want to go or not. Crichton tries to tell her that Rigel is not a spiritual being and their Timbala is wrong. But she says that if he is the true Masada, he'll rise up and lead them to the light. If not, he will be killed. Back in the village, the Aquarians have started the celebration, and Rigel tells Dargo and Crichton that the ancestors of the Aquarians were colonists sent out during the reign of Rigel X to expand the influence of his people's monarchy. But they were abandoned, and the power drain is intentional. They were kept here by it to devotedly worship the family of Rigel. The priestins have made a lot of the religion up and elevated them to gods in order to elevate the priestins. He says that he will explain that to them, but Dargo says the villagers won't listen. Crichton leaves, but Rigel says it's a metaphor, and he can't lead them to the light, but Neera overhears them talking. Zan and Aaron send down a projectile to try and let the others know the location of the power drain. Meanwhile, Rigel tries to explain that they have a lot to accomplish, but Neera confronts him. Rigel says that it's a metaphor that he will rise up, but Neera says that Timbala does not require them to wait, and Rigel says that he can't help them. Neera calls him a false god, and they seize Rigel. Dargo and Crichton get out of the way just in time, and the projectile lands in a nearby lake. Crichton goes to get it and finds the biomap inside. The Aquarians are planning Rigel's death when Crichton interrupts. He says that they have been betrayed and that there is a power draining device to keep their machinery from working. Rokon goes to attack Crichton, but Dargo stops him. Crichton says the machines function when their ancestors arrived, but they've been lied to, first by those who left them and then by the priestins. Neera says attacking the priestins is the highest sacrilege, but Rigel says no, that would be purposely keeping your people ignorant and subjugated for your own glorification. Rigel says that he has proof in the Timbala, which Kota Ray says only the priestins can read. Neera tells Rokon to kill Crichton, but Crichton notices some little handprints in the statue of the god. He grabs Rigel and places Rigel's hands on it, and the statue falls apart, revealing a great light. All of a sudden, Rigel's sled starts working, and he rises up on it. The people bow to him, but he stops then, saying he is only their sovereign, a worthy being like them. Kota Ray wishes that Rigel could stay, and he will tell the peacekeepers nothing if they come seeking him. He gives Rigel some food as a gift and says they've given the Aquarians the greatest gift of all, their freedom. Crichton thanks Rokan and Lashala, and she says they'll miss him. Crichton tells Dargo that he's got some apologies to make, but Dargo tells him to forget it, and they leave. A little trivia about this episode. The title and inspiration of the episode came from one of Ben Browder's favorite movies, Jeremiah Johnson. David Kemper was at Browder's house for dinner, and Browder's wife mentioned the movie to Kemper. Kemper stated, quote, "Instantly I had an idea for doing Jeremiah Crichton. Crichton goes native, lives among the people, and grows a beard. The next morning, I had the story in my head." Also, two of the last lines of the dialogue, in which Dargo asks Crichton, "Was it worth the trouble, human?" And Crichton responds, "Huh, what trouble?" closely mirror the ending dialogue of Jeremiah Johnson. Also, during the production, the show was hit with lots of problems, including a hailstorm. Pete Coogan remembers the storm, quote, "Hailstones the size of cricket balls came down. They came through the creature shop roof and through the production office windows." The episode also marked the largest use of the CG version of Rigel. This was due to the script by Doug Hayes not taking the puppet's limitations into account. Rodney O'Bannon also admits that this episode was not a favorite for many people, but there are still things in it that I find fun. He pointed out that this was a big episode for Rigel, and it was a good opportunity to show that as much as we try to avoid adversity and wish it never happened, it can change us for the better. Rigel is being treated with the deference he thinks he deserves, but it doesn't sit right with him. Even he comes to realize that it's just not right. That was an important adjustment for him. And finally, this episode is considered one of the poorest made and made light of by the cast and crew DVD commentary, which carried the title, quote, "When Bad Things Happen to Good Shows," which consisted mostly of criticisms over how the episode turned out. So what you think, Eric?
Well, first off, I guess when we were predicting what the title meant last episode, you got it right on the money. This was Jeremiah Johnson, which I had never heard of or seen before, so I didn't know what to expect, but you know, good job. You got it.
Well, even a blind squirrel finds a nut every once in a while, but it was a little unfair since I was familiar with the movie.
So now I'm going to have to go watch it to see if there's any parallels and stuff, which I guess the last couple lines seem to be, so I'll have to look out for that if I can find it somewhere.
It's got to be out there. It's a pretty popular movie.
But I kind of do and don't, now that I'm thinking more about it, agree with the cast that it wasn't necessarily their best episode. But it's not quite as bad as like Star Trek Next Generation's like Code of Honor bad, where they had like horrible racial stereotypes and whatever. You know, and this obviously did have its good character moments, which we're going to get into. I didn't really mind, I guess, the clothing style and like the culture of the planet, because I guess you have to show some kind of what happens with, you have no advanced technology and it's been however many thousands of years, because like Rigel's the 16th Dominar, and so Rigel the 10th. So if Rigel was like imprisoned for 130 years and who knows how long, so this could be like 1,000 years, 1,500 years, you know, who knows, right? If how long a Hynerian region, you know, monarch lives or reigns, right? So I don't really mind that they went with the style that they went with, since I guess if you're a designer trying to create a culture from scratch, it's easier to take something closer to home that you know versus trying to make up something from whole cloth. So, I mean, it was okay, I guess.
Yeah, there's definitely some shortcuts to our knowledge and association. You know, if you put somebody in these clothings and these type of cultures, we have associations built from our historical reference that point us at this. We know what we're seeing, right? You don't have to spell it out. It doesn't take very long to convey what they're trying to say because they're using familiar imagery. I will say I'm probably the oddball. I didn't mind this one at all. You know, once you get past the trope of marooned on a primitive society, planet/island/, you know, whatever fits the model of the story, I think this was better done than I've seen a lot of other marooned culture shows be done. Yeah, if we're going to copy a stereotype.
Yeah, and I was going to say, you know, I live in rural Pennsylvania. So, I mean, to me, yeah, if they use like, you know, the Amish for like a non-technological culture, okay, fine. You know, I get it immediately. I know what you're thinking. I know what you're going for. Okay, fine. But yeah, I mean, I didn't think it was as bad necessarily as the cast thought, because, you know, I didn't obviously listen to the DVD commentary to hear what their complaints were. But, you know, I thought it was a nice, passable story.
Yeah, like I said, it worked for me. I would rank this higher than some of the others we've seen, and we'll probably hit that as we go. But, you know, again, a little bit of a trope, but it moved the story forward. I would have put it in order before the other one, just from a character standpoint. I think the other one made more sense to go after, but that's nitpicking.
Yeah, we'll kind of talk about that here in a second, probably as we talk about people's motivations here. But I guess to start things off with, I mean, I'll give Crichton his temper tantrum. I mean, it's been at least, well, at that point, probably a year or so, and now, 3 months later, that it's a nice time jump, right? So, I mean, he's been stuck there for a year. His ship's, basically getting more and more like the technology of where he's at, not where he came from. So I don't know if that kind of feels frustrating or disappointing or whatever. So I understand it. I get it. And yeah, I mean, like, if we get upset or want to get away from people or our house, we like, would take a walk or get in our car and go for a drive. So yeah, sure. He's gonna get in the spaceship. He's gonna fly around Moya just to clear his head, calm down. No big deal.
Agreed. I mean, we all have hobbies, and one of his is obviously working on his ship, so it makes sense that that would be his safe space that he wants to go get some time. It totally worked, and I even like the contrivance of that being the trigger for Moya to Starburst, right? That she was protecting the baby at that point. So I didn't even mind that setup. It definitely worked in the context of the historical pregnancy storyline.
And then again, hopefully, the final use of this plot device, that he really thinks that they abandon him, which, I mean, it kind of, you could maybe see where it looked like that, but I mean, come on, guys. It's like, what, we're like 14 episodes now. This is the, what, half a dozenth time that they pulled this one. I'm like, okay, I think we're done with this. But at least finally, at the end, he realizes that he overreacted, especially when Dark was like, look, if we abandoned you, why are we here 3 months later? After having looked for you that entire time, dude, wake up. Okay.
Agreed. We beat this one to death, but they beat the plot point to death, so it's only fair. I will say that the one thing that I actually scratched my head at a little bit on this, and I don't think we quite have an understanding of Starburst yet. But and I realize that some of the Starbursts they don't know where they are in the region because they don't know how that original Starburst worked. But by this point, couldn't they have just reversed this Starburst and found him? It seems like 3 months is a long time to reverse a single Starburst.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but yeah, good point. Like, if they knew kind of where they were and then came back to that general area, yeah, like how many like Earth type, whatever, how many planets that could support Sabbatians, humans, Luxans, whatever, were there in that area, right? Like, how densely populated is the Uncharted Territories? It kind of sounds like it should be like vast because it's uncharted, right? If it was really packed together, you could probably chart it pretty quickly, right? So it would be uncharted. So yeah, I get that point. And I guess this time, to be a little different, this time Zan wants to give up the search. She's like, should we search for a while? I'm done. And Dargo and Aaron basically override her and keep searching. Which, I mean, maybe this is some kind of fallout from her not being a priest anymore for over the last couple episodes, which even Aaron commented on, and Zan kind of got really mad about that and kind of threatened her, like, don't bring that up again.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing some changes in Zan post that episode with her giving up the priesthood. So that's another point for continuity. I'll also say, as much as I've said a couple times now, that I think this should have been flipped with the other episode. The one piece of continuity that I did think carried through a little bit was that when they were talking about calling off the search or keeping the search going, Dargo was deferring to Aaron, and Aaron was the one who wanted to keep searching. And I guess I'll give that credit for her and John's relationship post the last episode. So, maybe it does make a little sense to have it here just for that one relationship plot point.
Yeah, and I guess even, what, 2 episodes ago, I guess Dargo, with the bounty hunters, Dargo finally, he and John have some kind of understanding. Like, they're not friends per se, but they're, whatever you want to call it, allies, comrades. They're in the same boat together, so to speak. So that they maybe are building that loyalty, that camaraderie of like, I'll do anything to help my friend, not friend, because they weren't friends, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, although I will say after this episode, I kind of get the sense that that's changing. Now that he's rescued him once in the last episode, and then now this episode again he was the one that came down and got him on the planet. I kind of think that we're moving past that ally stage a little bit. But agreed, that was their agreement.
Yeah, because I mean, maybe now, John's not disappointing Dargo anymore. I don't know. We'll see. At least John does admit that he wanted to apologize for running off in a tiff, and Dargo's like, "Yeah, don't worry about it." So, that's shows that kind of growth of their two characters.
Yeah, we've reached acceptance, if not friendship yet. So definitely forward progress.
And I guess the big character development, besides Crichton going native and trying to do his version of the Prime Directive and stay away from the culture, is Rigel. I mean, this is definitely, I guess, the last half, like a Rigel-centric kind of episode, where at first, when they worship him as God, he's like, hey, this is fantastic. You know, he's got people fawning over him, giving him food. They came to bathe him, which he's like, hey, all right. But then he finally, after he realizes what's going on, actually kind of feels sorry or guilty for what his predecessor, Rigel X, did by stranding everybody there, and actually kind of wanted to tell them the truth and not lie about it or try to bluff his way out of it, which I thought was, writers and creators said, was definitely a step up with Rigel.
Yeah, I think when you put these two back to back, you have Rigel in his element, right? Bluffing and getting his way with the pirates. And then you turn around and have him have to do an emotional, out of his comfort zone growth. So yeah, these were definitely two good Rigel episodes.
Yeah, I mean, he's not just like a one-note, the blowhard, the liar, the cheat, the sneaky person. He actually cares, because, you know, these were his people, effectively colonists, I guess, from how many civilizations or worlds that the Hynerians controlled back then. You know, so he definitely feels guilty about what his predecessor did and wanted to try to, for once, just explain, yeah, this is what happened. We'll try to help you guys, but, you know, I'm not a god. I'm just, you know, a nice, wonderful person like you guys are, and hey, let's all be friends. And almost didn't work out, but did in the end, because obviously then there'd be a short show and that'd be in the series. But
yeah, we just have the Aaron and Zan show, so.
Yeah, because the other ones left. So then they could leave. It's like, well, they're powered down there. Oh, well, we're gone. See ya. So then they finally could have actually left and abandoned their people.
Be a way to go out.
Any other things to talk about?
No, I think we've wrapped these two episodes up. Any final thoughts on the others before we close this book?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty straightforward kind of episode. Like we kind of said, not the best necessarily to watch back to back, but yeah, Jeremiah Crichton was definitely better than the Flax, at least for probably both of our opinions, if I can speak for you. So I mean, it's probably they aren't at the top of the list. I mean, the Flax is probably closer to the bottom for me. This one's, I don't know, middle-ish, I think.
Yeah, I think if I took the Aaron and John segments and just ignored everything else in the Flax and just took that one plot point, it ranks high middle. The rest of the episode drags it down to the low middle. But both of these were much, much higher rated, in my opinion, than like DNA Mad Scientist, which is so far my least favorite episode. And I'll probably beat on it a couple times, but it's an easy one. But yeah, I think I rate them higher than you do, but agreed. There's definitely some points in both of them.
Yeah, because like if you're like the completist and have to watch everything like we are for this podcast, you have to watch it when some people would say skip it. But then if you skip the Flax, you would miss the, not consummation because they didn't go that far, but like the realization that Crichton and Aaron have a thing for each other. So you kind of have to watch that all the way through to get that. Otherwise, you would miss that part and then like later you'd be like, what happened? Huh?
Yeah, I mean, again, from a completist standpoint, we're getting the build up, so it's always good to see the precursor as we get further down.
And I think I did say when we started this podcast that we'll be watching everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Well, these weren't ugly, but yeah, not necessarily good, but anyway.
Agreed.
All right, so next time, as we mentioned, it's back to everybody follow whichever list you find, because we're all the same. So we've got episode 15, Durka Returns, which sounds like Durka was that Sabbatian peacekeeper who imprisoned and tortured Rigel for 130 years. So it sounds like that probably was not his body on that ship a couple episodes ago.
Interesting. I had forgotten that name, so thanks for the reminder on that one.
Yeah, I think the only reason he thought it was him is because he recognized the ring on the corpse's hand. So probably somebody else stole the guy's ring and that wasn't him. I don't know. We'll see. And episode 16, A Human Reaction, which is very descriptive and means nothing. So we'll see what that means.
Yeah, that one's open-ended. So we'll see what goes there.
Yeah, that one we'll have no idea. So it'll be fun to watch. Actually, we both don't know about any of them. So we'll see how we go. We'll see how we do. All right, so that's your homework for next time, episode 15 and 16. And we will see you then. Goodbye.